Thank you, Mrs. Carlson, and a good afternoon again, everyone. There's an 8-minute video that's produced by the American Enterprise Institute. It's called The Surprising Moral Case for Free Enterprise. And they go on within that video to say that from the time of Pericles, which was between 400 and 500 BC, Pericles was a Greek statesman and a general in Athens, Greece. And from that time until the late 1700s, the world stayed on a per-person basis, stayed pretty much the same as far as productivity and living standards. There weren't a lot of changes, but in that time, since the late 1700s, and then for less than 250 years since then, the production per person, or the gross domestic product, has increased by 4,000%. That's a lot. It's increased more than 40 times in less than 250 years. Enormous productivity. Lifestyles have dramatically improved. And you can just think about all the things we have that they didn't have even 250 years ago. They did not have, and you can go on and on and on about the things that they did not have and compared to the things that we have today. I remember as a boy in the 1950s, the banks would advertise, if you open up an account with us, you can get a free toaster. A toaster was new, and it was a novelty. Years later, they had little gizmos or little things that they would give away to bring people in. But when America was founded, the fabrics were a rare commodity. You couldn't buy cotton socks and underwear. Those were homemade items to a large extent. You could get some factory-made one if you were wealthy enough. And you can go on through. It didn't matter whether it was tableware or not. Tableware was inherited from generation to generation because it was so valuable. Today, you go down to a thrift store, and they have lots of tableware and that sort of thing. And so it's a fair question to ask. Of course, we have flush toilets, digital everything right now in the last generation's come. But it's fair to ask, why has there been such a dramatic increase in the living standards in less than 250 years? And W. Cleon Skousen, in his book, The 5,000-Year Leap, suggests that an adoption of a biblical view of free enterprise will explain the increase. But not everybody buys into that. Some people will set up a supposed conflict between the concept of cooperation and competition as if those were opposite, polar opposites, and then they will condemn competition as being ungodly and hold up cooperation as being godly. Well, today I want to examine the biblical references to see if there is a biblical concept to embrace one to embrace a biblical command to embrace one concept over the other, and understand how these principles may be important in our personal lives. You might entitle this message A Biblical View of Competition and Cooperation. A Biblical View of Competition and Cooperation. Now, according to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, cooperation is a common effort, the act of cooperating, or an association of persons for common benefit. Well, I'm a member of several co-ops. One of my co-op suppliers is my electrical company, and I have other ones. One is a farm supply co-op, and for farm service providers, some of the basic products there, where farmers get together and form a company. And those co-ops are formed for a specific purpose. Some of you may be part of a natural foods co-op that we have here. And each person who's a member of a co-op, they've got one vote per year for the board of directors to see oversees the company. And then co-op members then get to produce items through the co-op that they may not normally be able to get otherwise. So that's a term, the noun cooperative. And I've grown up with that. I know my family farm had dairy cows that I grew up with, and they sold their milk through a dairy cooperative called Land O'Lakes. Some of you may be familiar with it. Later down, that was part of what they called First District Association, a member co-op of that, where the farmers all sold their milk to the same processing plant and then shared in any potential profits. There are examples of co-ops or cooperative efforts in the Bible. And if we turn to Genesis 5:32, we read an early example of cooperation. In Genesis 5:32, we had Noah had three sons at the age of 500. We're not talking about the cooperation between him and his wife to have those three sons. What we're looking at is what he did with his sons and each of their wives together. In Genesis 6, verses 9 through 22, we read about how God instructed Noah to build an ark. And so we start in verse 9, and Noah and his three sons. And why? Because the earth was corrupt. Verse 11, before God, it was filled with violence. And so God said in verse 13, God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence through them. Basically, they're going to destroy themselves. So I really need to wipe the slate clean here. So, and it goes through the example of how I want you to build an ark and how you to do it. And if we read down to verse 18, and then you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives go with you into that ark, and then some of each of all the land animals with them, male and female and so forth, and birds and so forth, and all the food that goes with it. Now, I want us to just pause. What if God had instructed you and your family? I want you to build this ark that's 600 and some feet long, and it's really wide, and it's really tall, several stories tall. And there are specific size arrangements, and I want you to get all this done, and I want you to make this a waterproof thing. It's got to be watertight. It's not just going to... not going to take on water, and it's got to have a door, it's got to have a window, it's got to have decks, and then the kinds of animals and how many need to be bringing. So that goes to Genesis 6, verse 22. After all these instructions, Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. What does that mean? That means he had to cut timbers out of the forest. They just didn't run down to the local lumber yard and spec out what he needed. And say, oh, by the way, I need the nails and screws to hold all of this together. And oh, by the way, I need all of the tools to build it. No, he had to go first create the lumber from the trees. But how do you cut down a tree without the tools, without an axe or a saw? And so we have they had to have tools. So he either had to purchase them, make them, or barter for those tools. Or make the tools themselves. And if he had to do that, make it himself, well, that means you had to have ore, metal ore. You had to smelt it. Now, there was technology in those days, so presumably they didn't have to do the rudiments. But he would have to be engaged in some enterprise in order to be able to purchase the items for which to build the ark. And then once you drop trees in the forest, how do you get them to the building site where the ark is being built? Did Noah use oxen or horses or maybe elephants or other beasts of burden? We don't know the details, but we do know this, that whatever he used, those animals consumed a lot of food. We took a lot of hay for the oxen or the horses or the elephant. And then, of course, what about the harnesses? Somebody had to make those. You don't run down to the local harness store and pluck them out. Now, maybe they had those at that time, but still then it would take some money to do that. And then, of course, what about training the beasts of burden? How are you going to get them to pull those things? So you've got the trees felled, hauled, the tools made, manufactured to lumber. Then you had to have design, how you prop these things up, how to make them all work. And no one person could do it. It required a team. It was a team effort. And how long did a team take to do that? It was 100 years. Now, we don't think we can get enough done in this lifetime. And we're right. But when we're given a project like that, that family had to do this in 100 years. My great-grandfather was a homesteader in the late 1800s on the Minnesota prairie. He had to build his own buildings. He had to dig his own well. He had to build his own fences and roadways, cut the trees down and make his own fence posts. There was no hardware store, and that was just in the 1880s. He had to barter or purchase the tools, and he had to build everything himself. The barn that he built is still there today. It's called a basement barn. He dug out the side of a hill so that the sides of the barn, he made stone and clay mortar so that he could have like a walkout basement for that barn. And by having a walkout type of basement, it kept it warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer for the livestock that were there. Although while I was growing up, we used the same barn as a dairy, and it wasn't cold in the winter in that barn because it was built into the hillside. It was protected from the weather, and the cow's body heat kept it warm. And then the summer, it was built into the hillside, so there was a natural cooling effect. But that required a lot of cooperation, and he had some brothers. And so the three brothers, each of the Martins brothers, built on their place something very similar, so they each did it, so that you can go back today and each take a look at each of those three places and notice some marvelous similarities from 140 years ago when they did this. And then, of course, there was a day that was the barn raising where they built the walls on the ground, and you may have seen this. I believe the Amish still do this today. They have a barn raising, and they tip the walls all up into place and such. And, of course, then there's a big celebration. And, of course, in that day, there's a barn dance, and everybody comes for the barn raising. So that was local cooperation. It was really very quite similar to what Noah, on a small scale, what Noah and his family did to build the ark using teamwork. Now, if there's another example of cooperation in the Bible, and if we turn to Genesis 13, we have the story about Abraham and his nephew Lot. And Abraham brought his nephew Lot to the land that Abraham inherited. God told him to go there. And Abraham's brother's son was apparently his ward. His brother must have been deceased. And he brought his nephew with him. The patriarch Abraham then moved from Haran in Syria to the land of Canaan. And they each developed, as we read in chapter 13, Genesis chapter 13, they each raised livestock. If we read in Genesis 13:2, Abraham was rich in livestock. Interestingly, it reads, and silver and gold. Well, first of all, he had to raise livestock, which means they were taking care of the animals. How'd he get the silver and gold? People often don't ask that question, but the way you get silver and gold, what does a farmer do with his crops or his livestock? He sells them to people who aren't raising those things. And so he got them by barter or by sale. And we read on that in verse 5, Lot also went with him, and Lot had his flocks and herds and tents for the people that worked with him. But the time came when, in verse 8, the land was not able to support, meaning support them both. And verse 7, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram, his livestock, and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So what did they do in verse 8? Abram said to his nephew Lot, let there be no strife between you and me, between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we're brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Let's separate, and if you go to the left, I'll go to the right, and if I will go to the right, then you can go to the left, or vice versa. So they resolved the issue peaceably. They said, there's no reason to fight. We will just put some space between ourselves. You see, Abraham and Lot cooperated in solving a problem, and there was peace as a result. Another example of cooperation we have in the book of Ruth. But first, I want to turn to Leviticus 19, verse 9. Leviticus 19 and verse 9. And there we read, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. In other words, you don't have to get every little bit out of every little corner, and there is a specific reason for that. We read in Leviticus 23, verse 22, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field. When you reap, nor shall you gather any gleaning from your harvest. In other words, don't have to go over it a second time. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I'm the Lord your God. In other words, he's giving instructions. Here's how you provide for the people that don't have the land that they can sow and so forth. So the people who are unable to plant a crop could still survive, but they still had to put forth the effort. And so the corners or the edges or the gleanings, the second time they go over the field, were left for the poor and the stranger. And that would include the widows and so forth. And if we read on then in the book of Ruth, and we turn to Ruth chapter 2, you see, Ruth was a widow, and her widowed mother-in-law, Naomi, they had returned to Bethlehem, the ancestral home of Naomi's husband, Elimelech. They had been many years in Moab, where Ruth's husband died. She was a Moabitess. They didn't get Social Security checks, no disability checks. Naomi didn't get a retirement check. They didn't have food stamps. They didn't have Medicaid. They didn't get utility assistance. But they took advantage of an opportunity that was offered to them, as we read in Leviticus 23. As landowners generally followed God's instruction to provide for those who could not provide for themselves. So we read in Ruth 2, in verse 1, there was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean from the heads of grain after him, in whose sight I may find favor. And she, meaning Naomi, said to Ruth, go, my daughter. And we read on, and she, meaning Ruth, left and went out and gleaned in the field after the reapers. She was doing what the very purpose for which the Hebrew instruction was, to allow people to clean up the corners that really needed it. Take the better part of the harvest for yourself. Well, we read on about Ruth in verse 3, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. And Boaz said to her at mealtime, they often broke during the day, the servants. And what did Boaz, he had to approach her and say, come and eat bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar or the sauce or whatever dip it was they used. And we read on, she sat beside the reapers, ate till she was satisfied, but she collected the grain that she had harvested. Interestingly, on verse 15, Boaz commanded his young men, say, let her glean even among the sheaves, and don't reproach her, don't stop her. In other words, just let her go ahead, even in the good stuff. Well, you can see that Boaz certainly was curious about Ruth, and she had no hesitation about going and collecting the grain, even if it weren't in the corner of the field. And then we read in verse 15, he said, or verse 16, let the grain from the bundles fall purposely for her. In other words, make it easy for her. Leave it that she may glean. Do not rebuke her. So if you have this, she was out there doing what she could. She wasn't sitting at home wondering what to do. She knew what she had to perform or go to work. And Boaz was cooperative in following the law of the land by the method that God had laid out in the instructions in Leviticus 19 and 22, and providing for the widows by allowing them to harvest. And he had his workers give a little extra help. And Ruth didn't abuse the privilege that was afforded to her. She just took advantage of the opportunity for whatever they left behind. So we have a level of cooperation there. for an entire country had a pattern of how to care for people who didn't normally have land for themselves or a harvest for themselves. We have another example in Mark chapter 1, starting in verse 16. In Mark 1, verse 16, ordinarily we think of fishing as something we do alone. My brother-in-law loves to fish. He goes down to the river, fishes alone. We think of it as a solitary thing. And we think of a fisherman with a pole, maybe a fishing line, a hook, maybe some baits. But historically, fishermen often used a net and would catch as many fish as they could at one time. Well, the disciples of Jesus who were fishermen had to work together to cast the nets and gather the fish. In Mark 1, verse 16, and he walked by the Sea of Galilee, meaning Jesus. He saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. There was a level of cooperation there in order to bring in their harvest. Verse 17, Jesus then said to Simon and Andrew, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. What was that for? The purpose of bringing in a spiritual harvest. I don't think they immediately knew what was going on, but they followed Jesus. But Simon and Andrew had a level of cooperation, a spirit of cooperation among brothers. And it's an example for us to follow. Just as Christ spoke in Mark 1, we have to work together, have cooperation to become fishers of men. And thankfully, we have a peaceful and cooperative church that's cooperated with peaceful and cooperative people who are called by God to do his work, just as Andrew, Simon, and Andrew did. And those are examples of cooperation and a positive effort. But there's a number of examples in the Bible of negative examples of cooperation. I want to go to Genesis 37 and verse 18. Genesis 37 and verse 18. And this is the case where of the 10 brothers of Joseph conspired against Joseph. They just were unhappy with what they perceived the spoiled little brat brother. They were very unhappy. They were envious of him, indeed jealous. So Genesis 37:18, when they saw him, the brothers saw Joseph afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him. Well, so the brothers now were plotting, how do you get rid of this obnoxious little brother, Joseph, who's clearly daddy's favorite in their mind? So in Genesis 37, verse 23, when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic. He had the coat of many colors. Verse 24, they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty and there was no water in it. So it was a hole in the ground. He couldn't get out. Verse 25, and they sat down to eat a meal, and they lifted their eyes, and they looked, and here came a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels. Now, they were traders. Remember, these are also Ishmaelites were offspring of Abraham, bearing spices, balm, myrrh, in other words, valuable products, on their way to carry them to Egypt. So now what would have happened if Joseph would have been left in the pit? He would have died. Couldn't get out, couldn't get water, didn't have food. And so he would have died. But in verse 26 of Genesis 37, Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? I mean, they could have just said, well, we don't know where he went. Nope, sorry, didn't see him. Too bad, so sad. He's just missing. No, they said, how will that help? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let our not hand be on him, for he's our brother in our flesh. In other words, we don't want to actually kill him. We just want to get rid of him. And his brothers listened, verse 28, and the Midianite traders passed by, and it goes on to say they pulled him out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and then these are like second and third cousins. I don't know how well you get along with your cousins, distant cousins. But hey, Joseph was worth 20 shekels of silver. Now, they were traders, so they knew that the Ishmaelites, they knew they could get more than that for him in Egypt. So, hey, they knew a cheap deal or a good deal when they found it, so they each think they made a good deal. So we have this conspiracy of the Ten Brothers is a negative example of cooperation. So all cooperation isn't good. We have another example of cooperation, and that is in Numbers 16 and verse 1. And this is an event that occurred during the 40 years that the children of Israel were wandering in the desert after they had the Exodus from Egypt. Now, they had rejected the opportunity to go into the land of Canaan, the promised land, because after the spies had gone in, 10 of them came back and says, it's just too scary, you know. We're like grasshoppers compared to them, so they wouldn't do it. And God says, okay, well, you're going to get 40 years in the desert, one year in the desert for every day that the land was spied out, until that generation died off. Well, we read in Numbers 16, verse 1, we now have the Israelites wandering in the desert. Now, God is still taking care of them. There's still water for them. There's manna to feed them. But we read now of this cooperation in number 16 of verse 1 about Korah and Dathan and Abiram. And what they did is they had 250 leaders of the congregation, and they gathered up against Moses and Aaron and said, you know what? You take too much upon yourselves, for the congregation, and this is their words, is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them, so why do you exalt yourself above the assembly of God? So they're saying, basically, every one of us is special, not just you. So basically, who do you think you are? Now, 250 is not a small number. That's a pretty good size number. And they had gotten together, they cooperated with each other, and I can see it where they were just boosting each other's approach and saying, yeah, we'll go tell them. We'll give them the what for. After all, look at us. We're pretty good guys too. And they would increase each other, the complaints, until they became accusers of Moses and Aaron. We read in Numbers 16, verse 20, that God wasn't pleased by this cooperation of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. In Numbers 16, verse 20, and the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from this congregation. In other words, stand back. Don't get close to these people. And then the last half of the verse is, that I may consume them in a moment. Now, I think it's fair to say after we read this, that if God ever told us, stand back, probably want to do that. And verse 22, Moses and Aaron fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of spirits of us all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the whole congregation? And then, so verse 23, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the congregation then and tell them to get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Moses, verse 25, and they went to the to Dathan, Abiram, and the elders, and he said, and he told the people of Israel to depart from the tents of these wicked men, and don't touch anything of theirs, lest you be consumed in their sins. And interestingly enough, many of the people of Israel left them alone, didn't go close to them. And verse 31, it came to pass, as he, meaning Moses, finished speaking the words, the ground split apart from under them. That's the rebels. The earth opened up, verse 32, and swallowed them up with their households and all the men of Korah with their goods. So they and all them that were with them went alive down into the pit, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. And then all Israel who were around them fled at the cry, lest the earth swallow us up also. Now, if we saw that, I imagine we wouldn't want to be too close. Earth opens up. The guys that God said to get away from dropped in. So, verse 35, a fire came from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. So Korah and his family went into the pit. The others were consumed by fire. So the 250 met an untimely and unseemly end. So that's a negative example of cooperation. Now we have in Nehemiah Nehemiah, starting in Nehemiah 4, we've got the Nehemiah was sent back to Israel from captivity, and he and there were people in Israel that did not want, or in Judah, that did not want them to be back to rebuild the Jerusalem or the walls and the city and the temple. And they were the local Sanballat, Tobias, and Geshem. And that was about 400 years after the children of Israel were settled into the Promised Land, that the southern kingdom of Judah was carried off to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. And later, the king allowed his cupbearer, Nehemiah, to return and become the local governor. And Nehemiah had in mind to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. But Nehemiah had no end of trouble from the local enemies, and they didn't want Nehemiah to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. So, though Sanballat, Tobias, and Geshem repeatedly tried to frustrate the Jews in building the temple walls. And we read that in Nehemiah 4 and verse 6, in the last time it says, "And they became very angry," meaning those three local leaders, "and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem," verse 8, "and create confusion." Nehemiah writes, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night." So they said, "We're going to watch out for these guys so they can't frustrate our building of the wall," because the enemies could see the wall was gradually getting built. There were still openings in it, and it wasn't done. And the adversaries in Nehemiah 4, verse 11, they said, "Neither will they know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease." They were going to do a surprise attack, a sneak attack on Jerusalem. Verse 12, "So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came, they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." Of course, be very watchful. Be very careful. So what did Nehemiah do in verse 13? "I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall. At the openings, I set people according to their families with their swords and spears and bows. And I looked around and said to the nobles, to the leaders and the rest of the people, 'Don't be afraid of them. Remember, the Lord is great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and houses.'" So then when it happened, verse 15, the enemies heard that it was that the conspiracy was known, that God had brought their plot to nothing. Then the people of Judah were able to return their work to the wall. And then from that time forward, as we read in verse 16, half of the workers worked on the wall, and the other half stood there with a spear, a shield, bows and arrows, and armor. And that created a barrier or fear. And those, verse 17, those who built the wall, who carried the burdens, loaded themselves. So one hand they worked with construction, and the other hand held a weapon, so that the enemies could all see it wasn't going to be an easy task to overcome them. So despite the conspiracy against them, the enemies of Judah had cooperated to stop the building of the wall around Jerusalem. They were overcome by positive cooperation from the children of Judah. So we've seen positive examples of cooperation of Noah and his sons, Abraham and Lot parting ways peacefully, Boaz leaving the corners of his field for the gleaners, and the disciples casting their nets, fishing as a team effort. And these people were rewarded for their cooperation. And we've seen negative examples of cooperation, the kind where people work against those who would be used by God to accomplish a good work. The 10 brothers of Joseph conspired against Joseph. There was a rebellion against Moses' leadership by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Nehemiah's enemies, Sanballat, Tobias, and Geshem, and others. We saw those things, the negative cooperation, didn't work out, came to no good end. Those who conspired against God and his servants. Now let's take a look at the concept of competition. And I can't really tell you how many times people have said that all competition is bad. Well, I find this real interesting because as an economist, I've taught the details of graphs and charts and formulas for many years about the value or effect of one way or another of competition. So again, I look in the dictionary, and the word competition means a rivalry as the act or process of competing, the effort of two or more parties acting independently to secure the business of a third party by offering the most favorable terms, or the two or more organisms demanding or acting active demand for some environmental resource that's in short supply. Or it's a contest between rivals, such as a competitor faced tough competition. Now, there's such a thing as negative competition. I think we've all seen some of that. We can read about it in the Bible, Genesis 30, verse 1. And here we have a case where Jacob was, was tricked into marrying Leah, and then was given Rachel as well. So he wound up with two wives when that wasn't his intent. But Rachel was barren. And in Genesis 30, Genesis 30, verse 1, Rachel says, "Give me children, lest I die." Her sister was having children, and she didn't. She said, "What? I've got to have children, because, you see, that was their level of social security." And I say small s on social and small s on security. That's who would look after them in future generations. And so in that sense, in other words, she had no hope for the future if there wasn't somebody there to look after her. And then verse 2, "And Jacob said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of your womb?" And so she was worried that she would have no children to take care of her in later years. And so then she says, "Well, here, why don't I have legal control over my handmaid, so you can have children with her, but they'll be legally mine." Okay. Well, now she's a negative example here of cooperation. And then, of course, her sister saw that her sister didn't have any more children. She had four sons. She saw, oh no, my sister's having him with her handmaid. So she tried to one-up her and do the same thing. And so now it's a rivalry between sisters. And there's a reason that we read in Leviticus that you should never marry sisters. And this is one of the issues. You have this rivalry that came on that was a negative example of competition. We have another example in 2 Samuel 15 and verse 1. In 2 Samuel 15 and verse 1. And that is, when there's a king, there's always the question, who's going to be the next one on the throne? What's going on? And we call the people that are watching all of this court watchers. Who's going to rise through this, through the events? And normally the law of primogeniture is such that the eldest will inherit the throne. And so there was this struggle as to who's going to inherit the throne in 2 Samuel 15:1. And we read about Absalom looking to usurp the throne from his father, King David, back in the United Kingdom, when David was the king over Israel and Judah. And we have the event of Absalom attempting to compete for the throne and even boot out his own father from the kingship. We have another example of a king of David trying to do that, and that is in 1 Kings chapter 1, starting in verse 5, we have David's son Adonijah saying, "I will be king." And he prepared himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Well, that's like saying, "I'm going to have the presidential limo and all the Secret Service, and I'm going to make myself look like the king and adorn himself." Because when David died, Adonijah said, "Well, I'm just going to seize the throne here." But then we have in verse 11, Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, saying, "Haven't you heard that Adonijah has become king and our Lord doesn't know it?" And so he gives advice to Solomon's mother. It says, this is what you need to do if you're going to secure the kingship after David. Follow through with this. And then later, in fact, Bathsheba and Solomon did so, and Solomon became the king. And Adonijah was not allowed to become the king. So there was this struggle, and this struggle seems like it's happening everywhere. Who's going to be the boss? Somebody wants to be in charge. So you've got this struggle, and it's been going on for the last 6,000 years of recorded human history, of somebody compared to somebody else thinks that they should tell somebody else what to do. And it's been a remarkable human history in that way. The next example we have in Daniel, starting in verse 48, in the book of Daniel 2, verse 48, Daniel 2, 48. And the king promoted Daniel. Now, the king was the emperor of Babylon. The emperor, king of Babylon, appointed Daniel to be an administrator. And Daniel was an administrator under multiple kings, but a new king took over in Daniel 6, verse 1. And so you have this men who didn't like Daniel try to conspire against him. They said, you know what, this foreigner has got too much power. So we found a way that we can dump him by making claims against Daniel. Verse 4, the governors and satraps sought to find a charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they couldn't find any charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Wouldn't it be really neat if our enemies all were looking to find fault with us? And they said, sorry, can't do it. We've looked everywhere, dug through them, and we can't do it. But that's what was said about Daniel. And verse 5, and the men said, we can't find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So they were envious of Daniel, and they couldn't advance their own power unless they could diminish his. Doesn't that sound familiar? Where people, the only way they can get ahead is to try to bring down somebody else. So I would call that an example. So they employed lies and trickery. So that's another example of negative competition. One of the nastiest ones is in Esther, the book of Esther, starting in chapter 3 and verse 1. And the Jews were in captivity under King Ahasuerus. And there was a leader under the king named Haman, and he was very jealous of a Jew named Mordecai. And so he was trying to figure out how to get rid of him. Haman wanted to have power to himself and not be challenged at all. And so that was a problem. So, well, one way to get rid of Mordecai and indeed Esther, who became the new queen, is to get the king to sign a thing that says, kill all the Jews. We hear a lot about that in the news these days. That's nothing new. Get rid of them all. And so you have this negative example of competition that God did not allow to bring to fulfillment. As we read about in the book of Esther, where what did the conspirator do? In Esther chapter 7, Haman had built a gallows to hang Mordecai on. And what did the king say? And let's follow it up here in verse 8, 9, and 10. The king said, hang him, meaning Haman, hang him on his own gallows. And so verse 10, they hung Haman on his own gallows that Haman had prepared for Mordecai. This competition for power goes on and on. In 2 Kings 2, in verse 1, we have a queen called Athaliah, the daughter Athaliah, whose son died. What did she do? She wanted the power for herself, so she destroyed all of the royal heirs, her kids and grandkids, wiped them all out. thought that she would then have the power all to herself, but she missed one. One of the deceased king's son was snuck away, and he was hidden for some time until he was 6 years old. But you have this willing to kill family members just to consolidate her power. And then we have positive examples in the Bible of competition. And competition, remember, is a struggle for two parties over a particular objective. And we look in Genesis 14:1. Now, remember earlier the example of cooperation we had between Abraham and Lot. And they separated peacefully and said, you know, you go your way, I'll go mine, and our people will be fine. We won't get into fights. But if we read in Genesis 14 in verse 1, there were five kings who cooperated to kidnap Lot. Now, why would they do that? Well, if you kidnap a rich man, what are they going to get? All of his stuff and maybe even some, and all of his goods and all of his servants. And they hauled him off. And if we read on, then, what did Abraham do in Genesis 14 and verse 13? One who had escaped came and told Abram, later named Abraham, about it. And when Abraham heard that his brother, meaning his brother's son, was taken captive, he armed 318 trained servants who were born in his house, meaning they had to be fit young men, and went in pursuit, put them on horses, they were all armed, and pursued a long ways, and had a program by which his servants attacked and recaptured then Lot and all of Lot's goods and brought them back, as well as the women and the people that they had kidnapped. So you have this where Abraham says, no. This is not going to stand. We're not going to have this problem. We have David versus Goliath, another positive example of competition. We read about this in 1 Samuel 17, starting in verse 1, where the Philistines were attacking the Israelites, and David was a teenager at the time, or so it appears. And so a giant named Goliath from the Philippines came out and challenged. Now, historically, what they would often do is you take your strong man on one side and you put your strong man on the other side, let the two heroes fight, and then whoever wins, wins, and the others have to run away. This saves a whole lot of hassle. But nobody in Israel was willing to fight the giant. And David, who was visiting his brothers, was aghast that nobody was willing to stand up. And he said, and David stood up and was just shocked by all this. And he says, shall I allow him to profane God? This was shocking to David that Goliath would allow a Philistine to profane God. Now, the Philistines were on one mountainside, and there's a valley, and then another mountainside had the Israelites. And so... and of course, down in the middle runs a creek. You know, the water from the mountains runs down. And so, if we read then through 2 Samuel and on to chapter 25 and verse 17, the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up to defy Israel?" And of course, and the king will be the, whoever kills this man, the king will enrich him with great riches, give him his daughter to wife, and give his father's house exemption from taxes. Well, that's pretty good incentive. You can marry the king's daughter, never have to pay taxes again in your life, be a wealthy man just by killing this, this giant, of the land. But you see, what David was most concerned about was this Goliath was standing up profaning God, and David, he was unwilling to let that stand. And so he knew that God would be with him, and he was right. We have another example positive example of competition where people who stood up and God was with them, and that is Elijah versus the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel in 1 Kings 18. 1 Kings 18 has lots of interesting lessons in it. And Elijah's a prophet, and he's coming up, and King Ahab, evil King Ahab, led the prophets of Baal. And Elijah came to the people. The children of Israel were there at Mount Carmel. And verse 21, Elijah came to the people and said, "How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." And the people said not a word. Imagine that. What could they say? They were already been forced to follow Baal, and some of them were doing it voluntarily. Even if they thought Elijah was the right one to follow God, they weren't really to cross Ahab because they didn't want to lose whatever benefit they perceived from him. And verse 22, then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men." See, at the time, Elijah thought he was the only one left. He didn't know that there were others that were saved behind far away in caves. But he said, "Hey, I'm it. This is it. You can choose to worship God or you can follow Baal. So I'll tell you what, let's work a deal out here. We'll have this altar built and we'll put two bulls on this altar for a sacrifice. And they can cut the bull up into pieces and pile the wooden, put it on the wood, but don't put any fire on it, and then we'll put wood over here and cut up a bull for the offering, but no fire under mine. And then you can tell Baal to light your fire, and then I will call on the true God to light the fire here. And we'll see which sacrifice gets burned." In verse 25, and Elijah tells the prophets of Baal, "You go ahead and you choose the bull you want. And then you call upon the name of your God, but don't put any fire under it." And verse 26, they took the bull and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, hear us." But there was no voice. No one answered. They leaped about the altar in which they had made. So morning until noon. Verse 27, when it was at noon, Elijah mocked them and said, "Cry aloud, for if he's a god, either he's meditating, or busy, or he's on a journey, perhaps he's sleeping and must be awakened." So they cried aloud and cut themselves as their custom. They were just cutting their skin. But there was no voice, no one answered. It's sort of like going to a Protestant or Catholic church and expecting God to answer your prayer. And you can do all of those things and go through all the motions, but you're not going to get the benefit. In 1 Kings 18, in verse 30, Elijah said to the people, "Come near to me." So the people came to him. And then, of course, it goes through and sets up the altar to the true God. And then he called, and then he had it doused with water. And you have the water, because you see the other guys didn't have water on their altar. And he said, now this is during a drought. And so they had to go somewhere to get the water. And he said, "Douse it with water, dig a trench around it, and then go do it again. Do it a second time," verse 34. And then he said, "Do it a third time." So there was water all around. And by the time the evening sacrifice, in other words, it took time to do this, then that's when at evening, verse 38, the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust. It licked up the water. It didn't burn just the sacrifice. It also did all of the water that was in the trench. And now the people, they weren't speechless anymore. Because remember earlier he said, well, if Baal's the God, then follow him. But if the true God is God, follow him. And what do they say in verse 39? And the people saw it, fell on their faces, and said, the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. 1 Kings 18, verse 40, Elijah said to them, seize the prophet of Baal's. Do not let one of them escape. They seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kidron and executed them there. It was it. They tried to compete against God. It didn't work. We have one more story about the story of Esther. She could have chosen not to be involved, and she was the queen, but she did choose, and we read earlier about Haman and Mordecai. But she chose. She had to compete for the attention of the king in Esther 2:17, 3:8, and in chapter 5. She had to compete for the attention. He had many interests. And presumably the king had other consorts beside the queen. So she had to get his interest somehow, and she developed a way to do that. That was a positive benefit of cooperation, where she got the king to agree to her. Well, how do we then apply these principles? We look at Proverbs 26 and verses 4 and 5 about competition and cooperation. Let's read into it and look at the principle. In Proverbs 26 verses 4 and 5, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. And now verse 5, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. What you're looking at here is you've got to answer according to the circumstances. Sometimes cooperation is good. Sometimes cooperation is bad. You've got to make good decisions. Sometimes competition is good. Sometimes competition is bad. And you must be prepared to learn the difference and how to make decisions accordingly. Jesus himself, in the book of Luke, in chapter 8, starting in verse 4, gave us the parable of the sower. And in this parable of the sower, he talked about the sower going out sowing seed, and some of it falls by the wayside, trampled down, and the birds devoured it, some on rocks, shallow soil, and withered because it lacked moisture, some among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked it, and some on good ground. And they didn't understand what it meant, his disciples, and so Jesus explained that was part of the mystery of the kingdom of God, was understanding the parable of the sower, that the crops were going to compete, what? For moisture, for depth of soil, for thorns and weeds. There was going to be competition in order to be productive for good truth. And he tells us this in Luke 8, starting in verse 11. And he tells us the example of this about the parable of the sower and how we have to not subject ourselves to the things that don't work. It's really about decision making. Now, I think this was 40 years ago that the Indiana Jones movies first came out? Those of you that are under 60 may have a hard time remembering that. But there were a whole series of Indiana Jones movies. And I remember one of them was the hero, Indiana Jones, in the movie The Last Crusade. He was supposedly attempting to retrieve the Holy Grail. And this was a cup that supposedly was used by Jesus at the Last Supper. And, of course, certain religions or sects want to make these things to honor things rather than God. And so the movie was about in search of this grail, this cup. And of course, he's faced with this jeweled cup, a choice there, among all these other fine jeweled cups. Which one, he's in the cave, which one is actually the one? And his competitor picked the jeweled cup. And it was kind of a pretty saucy thing in the movie, how the hero of the movie, his competitor, melted because he chose the wrong cup. he picked this jeweled cup, and the knight that was protecting the cup said he chose poorly. Well, then the hero, Indiana Jones, he was supposed to be one that would pick the cup, and he chose the plain cup. He thought that would be one used by the carpenter in the first century, and he picked it up, and the knight protecting the cup remarked in the movie, "You chose wisely." Well, that's our task. Our task is to choose wisely when faced with difficult decisions. After all, isn't that God's purpose in working our lives on this earth to help us make godly decisions? So every day we see before us negative and positive examples of cooperation. And we see negative and positive examples of competition. And there are times it's important to cooperate, to work together with others to achieve a noble purpose. And there's times to avoid cooperating with others when we perceive that the cooperation doesn't work a godly purpose. So when we should avoid competition to promote harmony and peace, there are those times. But then there's times when we should embrace competition as a tool to bring out ourselves and others, to reach for and attain the prize. I know in economics classes, we would have the example of four gas stations building at an intersection. And you would think, oh no, they're all going to die because, you know, they're competing with each other. And you had one gas station on the corner, it has the lowest gas price. And then you'd think everybody's going to go there. But the other gas station had the best service because it had the best traffic pattern. It was the easiest to get out, easiest to get in, had the modern, easy-to-use pumps, longest hoses. And then the next station had the best selection of convenience store products. I mean, if you wanted a barrel of popcorn for 50 cents, I mean, that was yours. You could go there. And then the fourth gas station, well, it had a drive-thru with a fast food outlet on it. So it was going to draw. They each had something that had a different emphasis that was attractive to customers. And as a result, even though they were on one intersection, all four gas stations would thrive, even though they were competing in the gas station. And yet, if you put each one of them a quarter mile apart and four stations in a mile, they would likely all go out of business because it wasn't a destination. So learning where and when and how to use the positive examples of cooperation and constant competition will help us to make make good decisions. We're going to have competition in the kingdom to produce the best, but we don't want to cooperate with sin. We want to compete to be the best of something. Each one of us has qualities within us that make us good at something. We may not all know what that something is, but all of us are good at something and are not good at something else. I've got a mechanic in my area who's fixing a trailer. He's good at all of that stuff. He's going to make sure the wiring is right and setting up a spare tire bracket on it. And he's got the equipment to do that, but he would never pass an English test. Okay. I could at least get a C in English. But I'm just saying is that some people are good at some things and some are good at other things. Some people have to strive to get good grades so they can be promoted or to get a higher pay or a new job. If you are selling your house in the real estate market, what do? You spruce it up. You want to be able to compete in the marketplace so you can sell it quicker or perhaps get the price that you wanted. So if we are looking in the final analysis, it's not the tool you use, but how you use the tool. Our prayers to God should include asking for wisdom when and how to cooperate and when and how to compete.